kind of like when people went from, when gunpowder was invented, it changed the scope of things, but it was just a more sophisticated type of weapon. Then airplanes changed the nature of war too, but it was still basically you attack this area, they attack that area, and little battles here and there, maybe many people killed, but little battles in the scope of things now. To say that nuclear war is a whole new scope of things is not to belittle the grief and agony that resulted from other wars. If any of you fought in previous wars, or if you know people who were killed or wounded in them, you know the grief is beyond belief, beyond understanding to most of us. And yet nuclear war, for the first time, we have the possibility to do that to every person on Earth. I mean, we could literally destroy the world in one day's time if we wanted. And that's what makes this a whole new ballgame. We can't talk as if, yes, this is one new advanced warfare. It's a whole new type of war. The U.S. and the USSR contain about 96% of the world's nuclear arms stockpiles. Almost everything is us or the Soviet Union's. And between the two of us, we're roughly equivalent. They may have a slightly greater explosive capability, but we have higher technology, more sophisticated, more accurate weapons. And so the numbers I'm giving you for the U.S. would be roughly equaled by the Soviet Union. First of all, we have over warheads in the U.S. Warheads. These range from mines that are almost as explosive as the Hiroshima bomb to Titan II missiles, intercontinental missiles that are about 700 times that powerful. And the total explosive power of this is almost inconceivable. It's the U.S. alone has the equivalent of, they measure explosive capability by pounds of TNT or tons of TNT. So a weapon that is a 1 kiloton nuclear explosive would be equivalent of a ton of TNT in explosive capability. The U.S. alone has the nuclear equivalent of 3,000 pounds of TNT for every man, woman, and child in the entire world. That means if we wanted to divide it up, or if you could divide it up this way, you could blow up each person with the equivalent of 3,000 pounds of TNT, which obviously there's no desirability to do that. There's no way you could do it if you chose to, because the weapons come in lumps, not in one person doses. But nevertheless, talking 3,000 TNT for every person, that's a lot of explosives. It's far more than I think anybody would argue that we need. The argument for why we have so many basically comes from the idea that the Soviet Union might have a first strike. They might attack us by surprise, and in the process, by aiming at our weapons, they could destroy some of them. Maybe they could destroy most of them. I don't think anybody is going to even theoretically argue they could destroy all of them. But let's assume they could destroy almost all of them. There was a movie last week here on Ruth Youngdong Nelson, and she was protesting the deployment of a new Trident submarine. It was being brought into Washington, where there's a Trident port. And Trident submarines are a major part of our defense system right now. Let's assume that the Soviet Union would destroy in a first strike every single nuclear weapon the U.S. has, except for one Trident submarine. What would that do to the Soviet Union if that got loose, if we got one submarine through their attack and it attacked the Soviet Union? Well, a Trident submarine has 24 missile launchers, 24 missiles it carries on it, each of which carries 8 warheads, which means 24 times 8, or 192 different targets, can be quite far apart. We can bomb 192 different targets with one of these. Each of them is, I believe, and I'm not 100% sure this is correct, a 100-kiloton weapon, which means about seven and a half times the explosive power of the Hiroshima bomb, which killed 140,000 some people. If we decide that they're going to, supposing we wanted to target one city with each of these warheads in the Soviet Union, we could destroy each 192 Soviet cities with bomb seven times as great as Hiroshima, all from one nuclear submarine. And because 192 cities is kind of meaningless to us, and we don't know 192 Soviet cities, I'll challenge anybody here to name them, I'd like to, just for about 3-4 minutes, do an exercise. Let's assuming let's name 192 U.S. cities, major U.S. cities that you might want to target. And I wonder if somebody here could keep count just in their head as we go for just a minute. And I'd like to, I know this sounds different, but I'd like to take just a couple minutes and people think up major U.S. cities that you might, the Soviets might attack if they were attacking us.
He said there's only four in each state.
There's only four in each state. So let's try and name some. I'll start out, you'll just keep track, just rough count, okay. I'll say New York, Philadelphia, Washington, D.C., Chicago, Atlanta, Philadelphia, St. Louis, Minneapolis.
San Diego.
What?
Seattle.
Houston.
We have a rough count, Illinois.
Pullman, Washington.
Riverton. Miami.
Washington.
Washington, D.C.?
No, you said that one.
Portland.
Yeah.
Spokane.
Yeah.
Lake Oberon.
I missed that one.
Lake Oberon.
Houston. San Diego.
Oh, yeah, San Diego. Say it again.
Los Angeles.
Denver.
San Francisco.
Miami.
Got Miami.
Let's go and cheat. Now, come on, we've got to get 100.
Wichita Falls.
Wichita Falls.
Milwaukee.
Milwaukee.
Boston.
Kansas City.
Kansas City.
Des Moines, Omaha.
Des Moines, Omaha.
Lincoln.
Dallas.
Yeah, I've got Dallas.
Las Vegas.
What's that?
Boise and Bozeman.
Boise and Bozeman.
Mario Moorhead.
Grand Park.
Grand Park.
Fairville.
It makes you wonder why they go after some of these.
Portland.
Yeah. Eugene.
Portland
and
Tacoma.
All right.
Cooley City.
Cooley
City.
Yeah.
Helena.
Yeah.
Boise.
We're done, Boise.
Let's stop there for a minute. How many do we have?
We've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. 9 times 5 is 45. We got 47 so far.
So we're about 1/4 of the way there. One submarine can destroy 4 times that many cities. And again, it's not total destruction. There is, people lived in Hiroshima. New York City is a lot bigger city than Hiroshima. It wouldn't totally destroy everybody there.
We'll give them two.
We'll give them two,
But on the other hand, if you hit Rock Island, you'd probably destroy all 4 of the Quad Cities, right? You hit Minneapolis,
same thing with
you hit
Saint Paul. In any case, that's one Trident submarine, and I don't want to talk too much about gruesome things or anything, but the Hiroshima-Nagasaki days last week that were commemorated, I don't know if any of you took a look at this book. It's available in the bookstore for $1. I'm going to pass it around now. It shows pictures of what it did, two people in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. It's the kind of thing that you may want to take a look at the bookstore. I'll pass it around now. Again, 192 cities times 7 times the explosive power of this, all from one submarine. And we have U.S. arsenal. I'm not sure if it's 4 or 5 already completed, 3, 4, 5. Maybe it's more than that by now. Total plans are for about 20 Trident submarines. I don't know if they'll all be built. And they are also working at, by 1989, a Trident II missile, which is more powerful and so on than the one we've got on there right now. And in addition to that, we have 31 Poseidon submarines, each of which has shorter range instead of like 4,000-mile range for their missiles. They can only go like a little under 3,000 miles. But we have 31 of those, and each of them can destroy something like 220 cities and or targets. And submarines, as of now, are very tough to track down. And granted, they probably could hit a few of them, but you miss by a little bit, and it shoots off its weapons. One Trident submarine, in my argument would be, would destroy the Soviet Union enough that they would not dare conduct a first strike, or it would be suicidal to do so. Same thing with their attack on us. Presumably, if we tried a first strike, they would destroy ourselves. to the point that human life as we know it would not continue. And along with that, the fallout from bombing the other country presumably is going to, we're in the same northern hemisphere's air currents, and we'd suffer from theirs if we bombed them and so on. In addition to all these submarines, we also have over 2,000 intercontinental ballistic missiles, land-based missiles, over 400 bombers which can carry nuclear bombs plus cruise missiles tipped with them. We have a massive arsenal, and obviously a first strike might destroy a lot of them, so we might only have a fraction of that left. But before we get too paranoid about the fact that the Soviet Union, too awed by their massive defense, which is massive and something we ought to be scared about, we also have to remember that this little incident that was more humorous than anything of that 21, 22-year-old pilot who flew a light plane in and landed in Red Square, totally undetected by their radar system, totally nobody attempted to hit it, and as far as we know, they didn't even see it on their radar. And here it was attacking the most sensitive, for military and political purposes, it's as if it landed in Washington, somewhere between the Pentagon and the White House. It's not someplace we would want a Soviet, an unidentified Soviet plane to fly, and here somebody got all the way through the Soviet Union. So let's not be too awed by their defense, other than the fact, too awed by the perfection of it, because it is awesome in terms of power. They are roughly equivalent to us in explosive capability and so on. And the main point of this exercise of naming all those cities was just to let people think in terms of how big our defense is. It's not like you listen to the political debate on Capitol Hill, you listen to the debate in the newspapers and so on, it sounds like, well, should we or should we not build this new weapon? Should we go on this way? It's never a kind of, are we out of the ballpark of what we should be doing or not? Maybe we should be taking some steps to reverse it, other than we've been at SALT talks for 20 years and it's been kind of limits, instead of limitations as it's supposed to be, it seems to be targets that we all aim for. And then when they get out of the way, we just sort of ignore them or accuse the other side of cheating, and both sides have been about equal in how they're stretching it, how they're interpreting it. So what are we doing now? Are we cutting back? Are we beginning to think, hey, we've got enough, we were going to start cutting back? No, we're in the midst of, and it's a long-term thing, the biggest peacetime buildup in world history. And it's continuing, we're continuing to build up. If we decided tomorrow to not design, not build any new weapons, just continuing the projects that we're in the midst of right now, would continue a massive buildup for a number of years. In our search for security, I would argue, becoming less secure. And we're designing more powerful, more sophisticated, more accurate weapons, which one-on-one you might say, hey, this is going to help deter an attack on us, but looking at it all together, maybe it's more likely to accidentally go off and start a world war. So we keep building more, bigger, powerful weapons, and we are now bringing the arms race into a new realm, into the space, into outer space, and so-called Star Wars proposal, which is in theory a defensive system, but in practice, because, as I'll argue in a few minutes, both the Soviet Union and the U.S. defense system are paranoid, they will be scared that we might be able to destroy most of their weapons, so they'll build even more. And therefore, it is seen as destabilizing, and that's one of the biggest arguments against it. I'll argue that one of the other ones, that reasons for concerns about the arms race in general and Star Wars in particular, is the cost. In order to gauge what the cost of this is and how it fits in the realm of human expenses, I'd like to see if anybody can guess what the most expensive project, human project, in all of history has been. It's not a military project. I'd like people to guess what it is, see if anybody has an idea. That's right. The interstate highway system was about 100... What?
Sewage treatment plants have outspent the interstate highway system.
But, okay.
But not as one.
Not as one, okay. But as one unit, the interstate highway system, I believe, is 125 billion some dollars to build our U.S. interstate highway system, which I'm not sure that that includes maintenance or other things, but the construction of it was about $125 billion. The estimated cost for Star Wars are eight times that much, eight times more than we've spent on any one project in history. And a lot of scientists will argue it would never work in the first place, but I don't want to get into all of that. I just would argue that the cost of $1 trillion in a country whose economy is far from perfect and where we're already many years our deficit is close to $200 billion a year, we can't really afford that kind of new expenditure. So I would suggest that what we're doing is not slowing down the arms race, but speeding it up, both by bringing it to new areas like outer space and also by more expensive, more sophisticated weapons. To alleviate the fears of nuclear war, our government does spend a few of its $1 billion on civil defense, which is to protect us from it. And it sounds interesting at first until you read the materials, and these are from government materials that they put out for our benefit. These are also a little bit gruesome, so I'll stay away from too much of it, but here it shows pictures of this family completed a door-covered trench shelter 34 hours after receiving building instructions in their home. Here are two non-athletic college girls who completed a four-person pool-covered trench shelter 35 and a half hours despite tree roots. And here it's just showing trenches in the ground people are piling sand on top of and so on. Anyway, when you get into reading the details of these things, and this is an $8 book that's published with funds from Department of Energy, you start reading the things in it, it's awful. You read about the nurses and the medical care, and it does point out, however, first aid instructions do not include advice about what to do for serious injuries and sicknesses if no doctors or effective medicines are available, because which, in effect, hospitals would be out. I mean, at least the major hospitals would be, since much of the nuclear devastation is in burns. There are very few burn units in the country and nowhere near enough to take care of this. But it tells you how to deal with embedded glass, shock, this and this and this and so on, and points out how devastating radiation is to you and how long you should stay underground in these apparently just trenches that you dug a few days earlier when you heard the warning. But it's interesting that they never seem to talk about what you do in northern Minnesota in the winter if there was the threat of attack. They talk about building these in 35 hours. The ground's frozen several feet down, besides being that cold to start working in. And, yeah, you hope they attack. But then they do get into some things. Vomiting is certain to cause morale and health problems, especially for unprepared shelter occupants. Because this is the first dramatic symptom of radiation sickness, and it tells you how to dispose of that without leaving the shelter.
What's some babble?
What does it say you're supposed to drink, and what are you supposed to do with your human waste?
They do have demonstrations of hose ventilated toilet buckets, and you cover them up. Somebody in our government was spending the money to just study about disposal of dead bodies. And a simple test with a dead dog proved the idea of sealing in a large plastic bag was impractical. Gas pressure caused the bag to burst. Anyway, that's enough on that. It's rather gruesome stuff. And this is 1979, 80. And this book was...
Some government employees working on it, though, right?
Yes. There is, in the last couple of years, we've been spending more on civil defense. This is not 1950s stuff. It's late 70s, early 80s.
That is the Federal Emergency Management Agency.
Yes.
Which was mentioned in the video, if anyone was here to see it last weekend, as being the group that was in charge of some other things as well.
And this book, which gives 70 pages to nuclear attack and another 50 pages to other natural disasters. warns you what not to take when you relocate, and they suggest firearms, narcotics, and alcoholic beverages, which I've heard several people suggest were exactly the things they would Yes. And in Minnesota, where I'm familiar with it, they had about six communities planned as relocation areas because the Twin Cities would be a target. Northfield, which is a community of about 10,000, they seem to live fine on their own without another 400,000 suburban Twin Cityites coming down there. I wonder how some of these communities would do it, but it also talks in here about what to do before you leave a high-risk area. Check your home for security, see all locks are secure. Close all windows, blinds, and shades and drapes to help prevent fires from the heat wave of a nuclear explosion. It's almost as if you're going on a couple week vacation. We did most of these things, and they talk as if you go away for a couple weeks, and then when the radiation settles down, you go back. But there's no home, no streets, no car, no jobs, no anything.
You want to make sure to tell the paper boy not to.
Not
to. Actually, it's the mailman who should be concerned about it. The letter carrier.
Anyway, I would argue that these things. I'll pass this book around in case somebody's interested. is not a solution, not something we can deal with as a solution to this. We've got to look at prevention, not what to do in case of it, because many people, I think, would honestly rather not live through it, to live in times like that, to die a few weeks later. But it is gruesome stuff to think about. Before
Northfield voted not to accept that.
They don't want us.
They were going to send Tacoma across the Narrows Bridge.
Well, our mayor voted, he said we wouldn't accept it.
Yeah. The funding for it was, so they were deciding they were going to tie all the federal emergency management funding to, if you didn't take that funding and didn't use that funding, you wouldn't get the stuff for tornadoes and hurricanes and others.
Yeah.
So in any case, how, back to the topic at hand, before getting into what I think we should be afraid of and what we might do about it and so on, how did this happen? How come if we can all sit here and ridicule what I think is ridiculous plans and talk about how awesome the nuclear force on both sides is. How do we get this way? Why are we so carried away? And our most recent general president, Eisenhower, had a quote that I think is really impressive. He said, people want peace so much that someday governments will just have to get out of the way and let them have it. And I think that sort of says what is happening. Government leaders on both sides, or every side, are so enwrapped in they're looking at things so closely, how much power this one has and how the Soviets have that much power. They're looking at it that way, and they could destroy this, and in theory they could do this and that. And they're missing the whole, they're looking at the trees and missing the forest. They don't see the whole picture. I'd argue that's one thing. Then another one is that both sides are, I'd say, paranoid. I think we ought to be. I don't trust the Soviet Union's military plans. They don't trust ours, and maybe we have to live in a world with mutual distrust. But mutual distrust is different from mutual paranoia. And there is no good explanation for what either government is doing other than that kind of paranoia and the lack of a broader vision of things. Another factor I would say contributes heavily to this, especially in our country, is the arms industry. We're in Washington State, which has a lot of nuclear generating things that are to produce weapons grade plutonium and so on, and Trident submarine base and Boeing and a lot of aerospace industry stuff here, all of which has impressive lobbying clout and is lobbying for it. I would argue, I have a lot of friends, and I know there are a lot of Holden people who have participated in the Honeywell project in Minnesota, which is a project that goes out every few months and goes to Honeywell and protests against their weapons activity. And the chairman of the board of Honeywell always says, well, He thinks their protests are misguided. If he wants to change U.S. military policy, ought not go to the defense contractor, they ought to go to the government. And to a point, I think he's correct. I mean, the people who set the policy, the people who choose to purchase these, are the government, not the defense industry, though it kind of ignores the fact that they have a whole slew of lobbyists in Washington and a whole massive war chest to contribute to candidates that is all designed to say we need more powerful, bigger, more sophisticated weapons. And that kind of feeds into the whole thing too. And I would also argue the fact that the military structure is such that everybody wants to be, you want to be captain of a bigger ship, not a little thing. You'd rather be head of a billion-dollar aircraft carrier than a little destroyer or something. And so the tendency is to keep building bigger and bigger and more massive, and I'm not sure that that adds to anything to our defense either. But my argument today is simply that we are on the wrong course, and I think many of you feel that way, and I hope that those explanations of why we're heading that way, largely the paranoia, the lack of a whole picture, and the arms industry, are causing our government to be in the way of the peace, not just our government, but every government to be in the way of the peace that I think we can all say the people of every country really want. I would argue that if we were to spend a lot on defense, probably the most appropriate directions to be aiming at in terms of nuclear arms would be the fact that third world countries that are very unstable have dictators from time to time. Iran, we fed massive, highly sophisticated fighter planes and weapons to. Then it turns over to a ridiculously absurd, crazy dictator. If they had nuclear weapons, do you trust that Khomeini would not use them? We are sharing advanced technology with many countries that are unstable, or for that matter, terrorists, all of which I would argue is a more imminent threat to starting a nuclear war or to destroying a whole city than the Soviet Union firing at us or us firing at them. The next item I would say we should be equally concerned about is accidents. I got a list, I don't know if I brought with me, of about 200 nuclear warhead accidents over the past 30 years. And it tells, there was one, it was an armed warhead, but it was turned off at the time, that accidentally somebody dropped a wrench or something about 6-7 years ago, and the thing fired off, and it, because it was disarmed at the time, it was not going to explode. But the capacity of the warhead on that, I don't know if it was a Titan or what, but the capability of that was the equivalent of a railroad train the length of the country filled with TNT. That if it had gone off, that's the power it would have done. And you can argue, well, it was so far from actually going off, the missile fired in the air and landed. The warhead was disarmed, there was no real chance of it happening. But with this many, with 27,000 warheads that we have in our hands as a country, in the Soviet Union, roughly that number, what are the odds that sometime one of them might go off? I'd suggest that reducing the number of weapons may be helpful in that way alone. And two other things that I think we ought to be more afraid of when we're talking about expanding the arms race as we are. One is destruction of our economy and our society from within rather than from military force without. We have problems in our schools, problems, our roads in many states need big improvement. We have many jobless people. We have many things that need to be done that we're not doing. And Eisenhower also had a beautiful quote, every gun that's made, every warship launched, every rocket fired signifies in the final sense a theft from those who hunger and are not fed, those who are cold and not clothed. This world in arms is not spending money alone. It's spending the sweat of its laborers, the genius of its scientists, the hopes of its children. And that is a real possibility. The Soviet Union's economy is a lot worse than ours, and they're trying to outdo us in the arms race is even more devastating to them, but because they're wrecking their economy is not good justification for our doing that to ourselves. And the fourth thing I would suggest we should be more afraid of is instability around the world caused by billions of hungry people, social problems worldwide that we could deal with. Why do we have immigration problems from Mexico with so many illegal aliens coming in, flooding across the border? Because there's so much poverty there, they see us as a hopeful place. Well, maybe if we took a fraction of what we're devoting to this massive arms race as a world, maybe we could start addressing some of those problems, and maybe we don't have to worry about much of the insecurity around the world is caused because some countries have a lot and other countries don't have so much. If we, with 6% of the population, use 40% of the world's resources, maybe some of those other 94% of the people are going to be upset about that. And maybe we ought to be trying to address world problems in an other than military security. So what direction should we be taking? How should we be going on this thing? I would argue, this is not for what we as individuals do, but what we as a country ought to do, perhaps. Two things I'll suggest. One is total nuclear test ban treaty. In 1963, after years of unsuccessful negotiations, Kennedy just unilaterally decided atmospheric testing of nuclear weapons. In a few months, we had a treaty signed with the Soviet Union, have not been atmospheric tested by us or Britain or Soviet Union since then. We still test underground regularly. Soviet Union unilaterally stopped doing that a couple of years ago, and they gave us a deadline. If you stop by then, we'll continue our ban. If you don't, we'll do it. We missed their deadline. They extended it one more time. Then they completely halted it. That was sometime in 1985, I believe. And I would argue that if we unilaterally stop a test ban treaty right now, they would probably go along with it. And that's something that's clearly verifiable. We can tell seismographic equipment located around the world, we can tell when they're doing even minor tests, and they can tell about us as well. And the main reason besides the cost of those tests is the fact that it helps us to develop more sophisticated weapons. If you can't test them, it's hard to develop them. So I'd suggest that's the first step we ought to be doing. Then I'll take a suggestion from James J. Kilpatrick, who I think is interesting because of he is seen as a very conservative columnist and commentator, and here he's suggesting what most people in our government would call a radical step. I'm going to quote him from one of his columns. What would happen if the president tomorrow should announce, without waiting upon a formal agreement with the USSR, he was scrapping half of our nuclear weapons, 5,600 of our strategic nuclear warheads, the long-range things and the submarine ones and so on. If he was scrapping half of our nuclear weapons, no strings attached, no conditions, no ifs, ands, or buts, these fearful weapons would be publicly diffused and destroyed. The whole world would come and watch. With the whole world watching, Gorbachev would be virtually compelled to take similar unilateral action. In January 1986, Gorbachev suggested a specific figure, 6,000 warheads for each nation. In the name of simple common sense, wouldn't such levels suffice? Both the Soviet Union and the USSR have accumulated strategic arsenals that are absurd, grotesque, ludicrous, terrifying, and wholly unnecessary to any rational concept of national security. By cutting our strategic arsenal in half, the U.S. would retain destructive weapons would retain nuclear weapons with destructive capacity roughly equal to 1.7 billion tons of TNT. That's enough to reduce the Soviet Union to a radioactive cinder, uninhabitable for the next 100 years. And of course, with a roughly equivalent arsenal, the Soviet Union would retain the capacity to do the same thing to the U.S. Trouble is, both sides have become so obsessed with arms control, they have lost sight of straightforward arms reduction. And I'd suggest that is something. The Soviet Union, on both of these two proposals, has at one time or another talked about them, depending on their government from time to time. We don't know whether there's still offers that they would accept, but both of those would be the kind of thing that the only time we've tried it in our history before, with 1963 atmospheric test ban, they responded in kind. Here they've had two times where they've tried and we haven't responded. Maybe we should try again. So those are the two types of things I would suggest we need as a start as a nation. But then the question I'd like to leave open for the discussion and give one more minute before the discussion, is how do we as individuals get to this point? I would suggest three steps, one of which would be elect leaders who are more understanding of the crisis and more sympathetic to reducing the arms race. When we talk about the SALT treaties over the past 20 years, as I said, they've been more increasing us to a ceiling instead of lowering where we are at the time. The next one would be apply pressure to those already in office, contacting them, writing them, letting them know our feelings. And the third would be to inform and educate others to do likewise to those first two steps. And that might be, there are numerous ways we can have of doing that. But I've talked longer than I intended to, and I think there are lots of people who would like to say things either challenging this or questioning things or adding things. So it's open.
As far as electing candidates more sympathetic to our point of view, we're in the 6th Congressional District, Washington, Representative Norman Dix, within whose district is the Bremerton Naval Shipyard, Fort Lewis, McCord Air Force Base, and I don't know how many thousand Boeing employees. Whether Norm Dix could get elected if his position and mine on these issues happen to agree may be very doubtful. In the primaries, he has not recently been challenged by any candidates that showed any particular confidence, whatever their points of view were. And of course, in the general election, his Republican opponents have all been about 20 miles to the right of Ronald Reagan. So it sounds good, but where do you suggest we might begin?
Okay.
Well, I was for a while in Don Bunker's district, but they redistricted me.
No, that was Kevin.
I will suggest a couple of things about it. One is that in order to, you're not the only congressional district or state that has massive military installations, and it is understandable that people who are working for aerospace industry or so on, which has received many of its contracts and so on from Defense Department, bulk of them in some cases, all of their work from defense, that they're going to be very shy about turning around the other way, which suggests that efforts may be best used in other places. That doesn't help you necessarily, or statewide, or...
My money could go anywhere.
Yes, you can help out in every kind of area. That's one thing, and the other one is education of people who work there. I would argue it's not in Boeing employees' best interest to be spending their time building military, or to that extent building military aircraft, if we can be working to reduce the arms race. There are clearly enough needs for civilian aviation and faster, quieter, more fuel-efficient planes. I mean, there's great demand for it, and if we as a nation stepped away from our commitment to that, it's not something we're going to change overnight, and even if we had the political clout to do that, you'd have economic chaos if you just threw millions and millions of people out of work because you say, hey, we don't need this anymore. You're not going to have overnight change, even if you had overnight political change. I don't know that answered your question directly, though. Maybe somebody else has a comment.
One of the things that I think about when I go to Ground Zero, and same with the people who are sitting on the tracks when the train comes in with the triggers for the nuclear weapons for the Triton subs, is that we have to do it here, in this location, in this place, because somebody who is over in Ritzville can't come and do it. So those of us that are the closest have to do it. And I think that's what has to happen when we have somebody like Norm Dix as our person to represent us. We have to have the help of everybody outside of that district. Because we can't get rid of somebody like that because it means too many jobs. We leaflet out there at Bangor, and you know, we try to talk to the people. In fact, there have been a lot of people arrested because of leafleting. And we hand them the things, and when the people are arrested, they hand the Nuremberg little thing to the people, the arresting officers, and because they hand them something. They exchange this little piece of paper. It's all very well thought out, and they always ask them, "Have you read mine? I'll read yours if you read mine."
Mm-hmm. My comment again, though, I want to stress that there are certain people you are never going to convince otherwise in certain political areas where industry, which rightly or wrongly, I would argue wrongly, believes that its welfare is in continuing the direction we're going, you may never ever have the chance to change that. And therefore, working in areas where the clout is not so strong, maybe I understand your point, and I'm not saying.
Yeah, it can be futile, though.
Yes.
And what really needs to happen is that everybody who lives right around the district ought to vote in somebody who's good like Bunker. And so it helps and then he can be outvoted.
I suggest that maybe the way we need to look at it, since we're so concerned about this other thing, is that this is a form of addiction. Just say no. We're going to have to just stop. Just say no. We're addicted. Look what the Russians are about to do. We better buy some more of this stuff. That'll fix them. And we're addicted. We keep getting a fix for what you call our paranoia. And Jen and I have a wonderful system. We're two old, retired little Devon shows, so we each got we bought our cemetery plot early. it's about 3 miles from where we live, so we will. Our ground zero plan is to walk 3 miles and lie down. But until then, we tend to keep saying no and very loudly. But I think if it could be seen as an addiction, because that's really what it is, folks. That's, we are addicted to this way of coping with fear, and it's doing what morphine and cocaine and all those things do to bodies. It is destroying us. We don't have to wait for them to do it. We're going to do it to ourselves. And of course, the other people on the other side, they're just as loony as we are. They're doing the same thing.
I think that's very interesting analogy. Other comments or questions or?
Well, you made a comment about how much money SDI will cost, mm-hmm. and I'm sure you're probably right. It probably will cost a fortune. And I would agree that nuclear war is just absurd to even think about it. But I'm afraid that if we got rid of all of our nuclear weapons, that our leaders would probably think that we would need to increase the size of our conventional armies and navies and the Air Force, and probably in the long run cost just as much or even more that defense budget than it would for any new nuclear budget.
The first comment on that, and that would be, first of all, but I don't know that any of us will live to see the day when we totally eliminate our nuclear arsenals. But what I'm suggesting, destroying half of them, is, as this column suggested, I don't know that that would bring us to that stage. And also, I would argue that we are doing a lot in conventional warfare right now anyway, much of which from when we see right after the U.S. ship was hit in the Gulf not too many months ago, and we were blindsided by it. I'm confused right now, Mediterranean. About when they were talking about how sophisticated the radar response was, and that we have such big, complex weapons that sometimes they're sitting ducks for enemy targets, that because you can hone in on where the radar is coming from. And that when you look at it that way, maybe it would be more effective to be spending more money on smaller things than these big things in conventional weapons. But I don't want to get into what's wise and what's not wise in conventional warfare. I would argue that there will be that tendency in every country to, if you take it away from nuclear arms race, to do that. But there's also economic problems in virtually every country of the world, too, that may get sympathetic leaders who would look for other ways to spend the money than more military spending, which is incredible in terms of dollar amounts. When you figure $300 billion, or that's more than $1,000 per person in the U.S. per year on military. We're spending a lot of money on it, and we could certainly use the money to help balance the budget. But other comments?
I'd like to recommend a couple of readings for people that might be interested. One on the arms race and its history, as well as other possibilities that we might look at. It's called By Faith Alone, A Lutheran Looks at the Bomb, by Dan Erlander, a Holden Village publication, available in the bookstore at a very reasonable price. And the other one, if you're interested in the background of this pamphlet that's going around, how it came to be, who the people are that put it together and so forth, a book called With Enough Shovels, which is a quotation from the head of this. And the author is Robert Scheer, S-C-H-E-E-R, a Los Angeles Times reporter.
Other comments?
I guess thinking of what the fellow was saying before this, I went to Whitman College in Walla Walla, and a few years back, they really pulled some strings and put together a first-rate symposium on nuclear weapons and nuclear war. They had three or four authors of books there. They had Senator or Representative Les Aspin, who's in charge of the Defense Committee, legislature, or Congress. They had the Assistant Secretary of Defense, Martin, whose son was going to the college. I guess how they got him there. It was a two-night deal. And I remember being just shocked by what the Assistant Secretary of Defense had to say. He had the charts, he had the whole bit. He got up there and he showed us graphically with the bar charts how many missiles we had and how many missiles they had, and how the fear was that if they strike first, we'd be reduced down to this many missiles, which would allow us so many that we could use in the next strike, which would reduce their missiles. And you saw these charts, you know, the bar charts kind of going down bit by bit. And by the third exchange of weapons, they had more missiles than we did, and therefore they would have won the conflict, and they'd be able to blackmail us and foreign trade and other exchange. And it was just sort of, well, maybe for him in the bunker in the, you know, in the middle of a mountain in the Rockies, this was relevant. But he seemed to have just missed. Where were we? And even if they were just trying to hit our missiles are next to Chicago. And, you know, the airflow was right into Chicago, Minneapolis. And there used to be missiles closer to where we are. And the whole attitude of the people who supposedly are the ones that we think of as, well, they know better than we do, so we ought to just be quiet and let them take care of it, was shocking. And this is just, you know, to a simple college mind who normally doesn't read up on this stuff, but he seemed to have missed some of the more elementary points.
That was one of the points I was trying to get at earlier, and namely that people who are very sophisticated in this area keep doing the same thing. And I think the Eisenhower quote on governments being in the way of peace kind of sums that up. And my reason for thinking that is that they are so engrossed in these statistics, you figure out, yeah, what happens if we do this? Then they respond this way, then we respond that way. And yeah, they're not thinking in terms of what each of these things means. Well, we can try and save this many lives. I mean, they estimate we can save 30 million lives or something by putting in fallout shelters. Save them for how long? They act as if, okay, then after that's all done, then you go back to the Mayo Clinic and get treated for burns. The Mayo Clinic isn't there anymore. You're right. They're looking at all the details and they're missing half of them. And they're missing the whole picture.
One of the biggest problems I have with this is I belong to a peace group for about 2.5 years. And we would have seminars in the parks and we would have rallies and we kept going and we got down to about 9 people eventually. And there's just no way to know that and to keep going. You just run out of power to get out Thursday night and go to the church, and everybody's laughing at you. And there's just no way to keep going. And that, I would think, if we could come up with a program that would give each individual the power to keep going, to work for peace, you might start doing something. But even, I thought I was great. I did it for, a year and a half.
Go ahead.
That's what John Nelson was trying. That's what they were trying to do when they had the federal trial for the people that sat on those tracks. They're simply trying to get the attention of the American people and the justice system. That's what they're doing. And I really hear you.
And as a result, we had a good discussion of this. I don't know how many people who were also here at that Ruth Youngdahl Nelson film a week ago. But there was a good discussion after that, and one of the concerns I would have about civil disobedience is when the purpose is to educate people, if it gets to the point where you feel you're being ridiculed, you're not educating in a positive manner, in which case change tactics, try something different. Again, realizing in everything in our political decision-making process, the final votes are cast by members of Congress and president signing or vetoing it. And that's where you somehow or another have to be able to have more than half of them listen to you. And whether that's by trying to let people know how powerful the Trident submarine is and how wrong you think it is, or whether that's by writing letters to congressmen, whether it's by saying you're going to do everything you can to vote them out of office or run against them yourself, or whatever, in trying to get more sympathetic people. And how do you know which ones are most sympathetic to your cause, for that matter? I mean, all those things are part of the process, that the end result is what you have to be looking at. Is the best way to do it by educating others or taking action yourself to contact people or try and replace people in office? We're in a political process, and I'm not familiar with the details of Washington State's congressional delegation, and I'm not trying to suggest to anybody who they vote for or not, other than they should look for the kinds of policies they want to move towards and make sure they're doing what they can to get people sympathetic to them in office.
John, can I ask?
Yes.
How many of the people here have any peace programs or forums in their congregations at any time during the year?
They're not well attended.
There are some. I mean, yeah, I know our church is.
We have a community fellowship that meets monthly, but there again, it's only a few from half a dozen congregations.
That frustration, I think, really is at the root of small numbers and short-lived. If you can get out and see something happening, but that realization that I'd do anything to get rid of that, but
it doesn't do any good.
Who am I when you've got all the big bucks in this lobbying group going for it? And I think, trying to get people interested and committed to go through that.
It's hard.
When you don't see any progress, when you feel internally that this is what I want, but I really don't even dare hope that it will happen.
But why is it the accepted opinion that the only valuable thing that Reagan can do that will ever distinguishes the administration is to establish some kind of peace treaty and disarmament. If he does that, he'll have established himself as being a good president for this, because this is what the American people want now. And if he doesn't do that, it'll be a failure. That's what it's come down to. And you ask yourself, why has this happened? You know, why is there this enormous feeling that if peace and disarmament and diminishment of the nuclear threats, that would be a big plus, and every American politician that's involved in it knows that would be a great thing to do. I mean, it's not that the peace people haven't done anything, it's simply that they don't understand that this movement in public opinion has been, it has been established. And it's very hard to fight when most of the people you're talking to say, sure, they agree with you. I mean, is there anybody who disagrees?
There are people.
I think there's probably too much pessimism in this group here on the progress that's being made. I think there has been quite a bit of progress in the last couple of years, and I think that Gorbachev and Reagan are getting awfully close to making some kind of an arms reduction agreement before Reagan's probably out of office. From what I've been reading in the papers, it seems that way. So I think a lot of good's been done, and a lot more good will be done.
I hope you're right on that, and I wish, I mean, these two Soviet offers in the last 4 years, I wish we would accept them, a total test ban, and also if you want 6,000 or if they want 50% or however, reduction in warheads. I think either one of those would be shockingly positive. And anyhow, back to your comment about pessimism, I mean, I don't know if this is an overly pessimistic group or not. I think it's a very... such a serious problem that the little progress we see in either public opinion or in political action is so small that it is frustrating.
I think you're general. I'm talking about one of the reasons you have groups that struggle is that people, during the peace marches and all that, there was a lot of, well, I mean, there still are, but that big push when that really got started, there was so much public excitement about it. Well, now it's down to the point where the people that stay with it are working at it. And it's not nearly as much fun. And it's not nearly as splashy. It doesn't get the publicity.
It's not trendy right now.
Yes. And I'm not saying nothing's been done and that we shouldn't be active. I didn't mean to give that impression at all.
I think I'm going to close on that note, but... there is, it's dinner time, there is progress being made. It's very slow. It's the kind of thing, if you give up, you're doing nothing and you're making no progress. So you just keep plugging away in each little way. And be happy to talk further about this with anybody, but hope that was helpful.
Thanks, John.